Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future. Your hosts are energy and climate expert, Dr. Andrew Parker, and midstream industry veteran, Adam Murray. Now, here are Andrew and Adam.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the latest episode of the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. I'm Adam Murray, here with my co-host, Andrew Parker. Andrew, how are we doing today?
Doing good, Adam. Thanks for asking, man.
Yeah, definitely. We are very blessed to be joined by Thomas Call today. He's a seasoned oil and gas investor, investment leader, got a good track record of financial, operating, commodity business development, investments, expansions. He's worked in academia, so lots to unpack during our conversation and really looking forward to it. How are we doing today, Tom?
I'm doing great, and I want to say thank you very much for having me on your podcast. I love our business, our industry. I've been in for 40 years. I find it exciting. Today's more exciting than most years these days. So thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's a great industry, Tom. And you know, for those familiar with our show, we like to start off with an icebreaker. And we were talking before we started to record about how much you like to write and read. And so I'm curious, just to clear the air here, do you prefer a hard copy paperback book in your hands, or are you an ebook kind of guy?
I'm a paper guy. The battery never runs down. He's your friend. I like the old newspapers. I like folding the darn things and reading them. It's just part of the quality of life in my mind.
Yep. Nope, I agree. I travel a lot, and I hate having a big bulky book in my bag. And I've tried ebooks. I've tried Audible, but there's something about like having it in my hands and being able to mark it up and fold a corner. You just can't beat that. What about you, Adam?
I'm an ebook. I'm an Audible subscriber. I've probably got a couple hundred books on Audible, but I drive a lot and I put tens of thousands of miles on my truck. So it's pretty easy to just throw on a book or a podcast and drive around and listen to those. So
fair enough. Well, look, Tom, we're super appreciative of your time today, and maybe the logical place to start with almost four decades of experience in the energy biz is to just share a little bit about who you are and your experience and what you bring to the table for this conversation.
Well, I entered the energy industry in 1975 when I got out of Connecticut and I went to Texas to go to school. I became a tea sipper at Austin, earned a petroleum engineering degree in 79. And then went to work for Texaco, where I was with the Middle East. I was in Saudi Arabia for a couple of years, then UK North Sea for about 5 years. And then in 86, it all went to $9. I went back to school, MBA, and then I got into the dark side of the industry. I essentially became a money and deal guy. But my specialty was bridging, you know, assets and cash. And that's where I spent the next really three decades until maybe 4 years ago or so, where I left that and was hired by Omar University to stand up a new midstream fund, a midstream center that would bridge the academic world and the midstream industry. And frankly, there weren't any around. There are about 160 or so energy centers in American universities, but there's not a single midstream center. There's a gap. Midstream is like the redheaded stepchild that nobody wants. It's amazing, because it's a huge industry and it's so important. And I get that brings us to where I am today. I spent the last four years building a midstream center, trying to be relevant.
You know, you hurt my heart a little bit being an Aggie, and I didn't realize you were Texas UT guy, and you guys just stole our baseball coach and
yeah,
man, that one hits
years ago.
Oh man, that is painful.
My brother's was at A&M while I was at UT, same years. And so it was at family Thanksgiving and Christmas and stuff. It was always fun.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, I think with that recent poaching of the baseball coach, the rivalry is renewed, especially considering they play each other in football this year. So it's a little bit more of a sub story there. But Adam, over to you.
Yeah, so Tom, I mean, you talked about opening the Midstream Center. We're all here sort of midstream centric with the Let's Clear the Air campaign and the Gas Processors Association. But, you know, what is your thoughts on the midstream? You know, why did you choose the midstream as far as being that critical piece? Was it just because it didn't exist, or were you working in it and passionate about it, or how did that come about?
Well, frankly, before I stood up the Midstream Center for the great state of Texas at Lamar, I was really an upstream guy. I dabbled in midstream here and there, as was required to, you know, for upstream. You have to have takeaway. And so, but it wasn't really a focus. But when I started looking at the academic stuff and the colleges and the opportunities, what I saw was that midstream was ignored. It didn't exist. There's nobody serving it. It was sort of mind-blowing to me. Midstream, I think the market capitalization of the industry is like the top 48 companies, something like, you know, $750 billion. They make net profit of $50 billion a year. They employ 350,000 people.
Right.
Nothing can happen. Old school carbon or new school hydrogen and CO2 without the midstream. And so I, being, you know, frankly, trained up as a deal guy over the prior decades, saw an opportunity where the very large, powerful value proposition existed. You just had to harvest it. And so it became a focus of mine. And I brought that enthusiasm to bear, you know, with the center. And I guess I could discuss what I did there briefly, the strategy, but if you want.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the Let's Clear the Air campaign, and really its goal is to, you know, dispel misconceptions about the energy industry, right? And and in academia, we've had a couple other guests on that shared their experiences in academia, being an oil and gas person or you know, a fossil fuel person, whatever you want to call it. But were there any misconceptions that you encountered, or any sort of pushback from the campus and anything like that? And if so, you know, how did you personally kind of address that as you were growing that part of the university?
Well, a great example is about 3 years ago, the university got a new president, and I went to meet him. We sat down together and he said, "Tom, you have to forgive me, but what's midstream?"
Yeah.
And I burst out laughing, and I opened up a PowerPoint presentation. The first page of every PowerPoint I've done the last 4 years is a cartoon showing upstream, midstream, downstream. It's a representation. It's, you know, and essentially the midstream was, you know, gas, oil and gas, NGL transportation, gas processing, NGL fractionation, LNG terminals, then terminal and storage services. That was my definition of midstream. And so I did that. I also came across, there's a lot of people that, a lot of professors that had, you know, they had a lot of technology, a lot of brains to bring to bear, a lot of capabilities. And I found students, I gave some presentations and they didn't know. And it was very clear to me that education of not just of students, of faculty, of the marketplace, highly educated, knowledgeable people, interested people had no idea of what the midstream was or how it impacted their lives. And so that became a centerpiece of the mission and the various, I would say, the building bricks or blocks of the Midstream Center.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, you kind of touched on it, but, you know, in your opinion, I know the answer to the question, but how do you think you bridge that gap, you know, of regarding energy production, delivery, midstream? You know, it's very important.
And Yeah. It's a good question. I approached it from a number of directions. I had a certain budget and I wanted 60% of my budget to go to feed seed capital to practical research by the faculty on industry-driven issues and problems. If you leave faculty their own devices, they'll do what interests them. It won't necessarily be tied to, you know, what industry needs. But my view is that, you know, I don't care if you're doing great things. If it doesn't move the midstream industry mission forward, I don't care about it. I'm not going to fund it. So I funded total of almost $2 million over the last 4 years in seed capital and projects. That is one thing that was done. Another thing, a second element, was education of faculty. Yeah. We have a lot of good faculty. And the great example tells the story. About 2 months ago, this fellow came in. He's a senior professor in mechanical engineering, fluid mechanics, fluid flow. That's his, centerpiece of his life. I had funded him over the last 4 years in four different projects, LNG fluid dynamics issues related to, the LNG trains. And he went into that in the beginning. He didn't know anything. And he came to me, he wanted to tell me and thank me for funding these things because he had become expert in all those issues related to LNG funding. So we'd taken an asset of the state, essentially, the university, and made it an asset of industry through educating faculty. That was a good example of that. And educating undergraduates and graduate students, I implemented a program which I'll call the module program. I knew when I was an engineer, I took all these engineering courses when I was in school. And I really didn't relate them to anything. It was just stuff I had to do. You had to know how to do this, do that, calculate this. And I really didn't connect it to anything. And the mission of this module program was to enable students to connect what they're learning to something real. And so I created the module program. The module program took 1 week out of the semester, and it wrapped the course materials around any midstream issue. It didn't matter what it was. This was in business courses, chemical engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, civil engineering. You know, it had to wrap it around and there had to be a project. I paid the faculty to create the module, and then I paid them every time it played. And I think the latest numbers were like 40 courses had integrated a module, midstream module, and about 1,000 kids or students had gone through it. And the mission, again, was to make what they're doing, their course studies, relevant to industry and also educate about what the industry was at the same time. A third thing, another thing, was what I call the midstream clearinghouse. The midstream clearinghouse is essentially a lot of information gets developed and it sits in one place. It's not spread around. There was an incident when I was a young engineer for Texaco. And I was in London. I was assigned a project or a white paper. We were having radioactive scale from potassium feldspar in the formations being produced offshore in the North Sea. We had a radioactive scale building up inside the wellheads. Nobody knew what it was, didn't know how to do it, deal with it. And so I was sent on a mission to find out what it was, write a white paper. I spent a lot of time right out of the movies, dusty tomes, big stacks in British libraries in around London. And I found a reference to an article research paper done in 1957 in Moscow at a university there. I don't remember if it was Moscow State or whatever. I wrote a letter to the professor. I have no idea, dead, alive. It was the height of Brezhnev in the Cold War, I wrote a letter. I got the paper back in English. It was amazing. It exactly dealt with the issue that was being handled. I turned that into a white paper, which became policy. That was pretty cool. So when I got to Lamar, I asked the provost, I said, what happens to the research papers that everybody does? Yeah. And I said, do they just get stuck in a drawer or a dusty shelf somewhere? And she sort of laughed. She said, well, yeah. I mean, you present it at a conference with your peers, and then it sort of might go in a special journal that nobody reads, except for the people focused on that, but it never makes its way to industry. So I found, with the help of the library and sciences people, I hired a data and library person. And this person spent the next 3 years building what's an electronic Rolodex of all of the midstream-centric papers we could find in the various technical databases that universities subscribe to. They're expensive. Companies don't subscribe to them. So what you have now, I call it the Pathfinder. You go to the search engine, type in whatever midstream topic you have, hit the button, and it'll come back with all the papers. And there are over 26,000 published papers on midstream-centric topics. And it'll pop up, and you could look at the summaries, look at who did it, look when it happened, and there's a link to the paywall, because somebody owns that thing, and it'll take you to buy it. So it's really just meant to be a Rolodex. So that's information transfer, and make all that research, the jillions of dollars of research and effort and time, instead of it being a dark hole and wasted, it becomes available to us, the people that go out and put pipe down and deal with issues. And so that was a thing. And then there's the usual, you know, webinars and campus events and industry, you know, events to try and bring, you know, companies, faculty and students together. The primary mission is to get these people, you know, pollinating each other, get the information flowing and educating faculty, students, and the university about midstream and how what they're doing is relevant and how they can be more relevant.
What was that resource? Just so people, that sounds like a really cool resource. What is, how do you get to that to find those papers?
Well, if you go to the, for Midstream Management Science, go to their website. It's at lamar.edu/midstream.
Okay.
lamar.edu/midstream. Click on it and then you hit the research tab. It'll take you to a page where it'll say, there'll be this box and it says Pathfinder. You click on the button and it takes you to the search engine. And right now there are over 26,000 papers are included in that electronic Rolodex.
Wow, that's incredible. I think what I'm still kind of thinking about was what you said when Adam started to ask you some questions about, like, you know, the new president walks in, doesn't know what midstream is, right? And this is, I mean, that's Lamar University in Beaumont, right? A major intersection of midstream and downstream that you would think would be fairly, you know, is fairly oil and gas centric. I'm guessing you had colleagues beyond Lamar at other universities that might not have been as friendly to oil and gas and midstream activities. What type of, beyond the Lamar borders, what type of headwinds did some of your colleagues have with respect to midstream, but maybe energy in general and getting more awareness at a non-oil and gas centric college?
You know, I have a hard time answering that question. I can give you some data points. There are about 160 or so energy centers at American universities around the country. I looked through a lot of them, and sometimes I saw the word midstream, but it wasn't there, and there wasn't really much interest. The interest was really in other parts, really the upstream or the refining part. And that was the opportunity, frankly. And so, and there aren't any professors of, you know, midstream technology or anything. And all the technologies used in midstream are, you know, there's a lot of overlap with the technologies used in refining and petrochemical plants and stuff like that. But I think there's a general issue with universities, people working at universities, their understanding of actual operation issues. I don't think there's enough cross-pollinating there. I think that was the pushback I got was this, you know, people have their day jobs, they have what their interests are, that's what they do, and they're most people aren't interested in new stuff. They just, you know, that's what I found. It's, you know, when you find somebody who gets excited about a new idea, it's not as common as you might hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what, you know, just I guess broadening the conversation a little bit. I mean, with all your expertise in midstream, what are some of the overarching challenges and opportunities that the industry is facing today?
I have a good handle on that one. Several years ago, I started an annual top 10 issues survey. And every year, the top issue was drawing in new people, young graduates, and what have you. I mean, by a long shot. And I'd have board meetings, and the people on my board are from, you know, large or major pipeline companies and service companies. And they complained a lot about being able to draw people in. They said there's this like bad propaganda out there about them. And I saw this and I asked the question, is it a bad place to start a career? Is it low tech? Is it dirty? Is it going to be gone in 10 years? Like, you know, everything else, you know, that's carbon-based. You know, this is one of the things people say,
yeah,
you know, replaced. And so I said, I thought I know the answer. I thought I had a good handle on it, but I decided to look at the facts. And so I wrote a paper, and the paper said, was addressed a challenging conventional wisdom impact in the industry, in midstream industry, and addressed the question, is the midstream industry a good place for a career, good career choice? And the answer is a resounding yes. I mean, absolutely. You look at the capital spent, $40 billion a year, $50 billion a year of new capital, not buying other stuff, new capital to build new stuff every year. In the next 10 years, it's going to be hundreds of billions to get new capital to build infrastructure to take gas from the shell areas to the end users. If you include taking gas to the new LNG plants being built around the country, it's like $800 billion over the next 20 years. There's going to be a lot of design, a lot of construction, a lot of high tech, a lot of cool stuff going on. That's one thing. The midstream industry employs about 350,000 people, you know, professionals. In the next 10 years, that's supposed to go up about 30,000 or so. A college kid, you graduate from any college with a STEM degree or an engineering degree, your starting salary, you're 22 years old, you frankly don't know how to do anything. Your starting salary is anywhere from $90,000 to $110,000 with a 10 to 20% bonus. You know, and the world's your oyster because there's a lot of development, a lot of also redevelopment. About 50% of all the pipeline, major pipeline systems in the United States are over 50 years old. That takes a lot of redevelopment, a lot of maintenance, a lot of tech, a lot of cool thinking. It's huge. And society cannot live without it. It's one of the invisible things that enables society that, you know, is required. It creates a lot of opportunity. The great opportunity right now for kids, frankly, is that there's such demand in the industry and people don't even know what the industry is. And I one of my missions was to try and correct that in my small way.
I come across people sometimes who, I've been looking for a job now for 10 months. And I'm like, really? You've been looking for 10 months. Like, you're not looking in the right places then, right? Because to your point, I mean, I think there's every company I know in midstream is hungry for talent. I think good human capital is harder to find today than ever before, right? And so I think those comments really resonate.
Yeah. Well, kids like Google, you know, high tech, Google, you know, Apple, all these sorts of companies. But one thing that people don't realize is that the, whether it's petrochemical, midstream or upstream, technology is the driver. It is just the driver. It used to be your grandfather's midstream company was the guy, you're a pipe and valve man. Nowadays, you're talking about there's a lot of data. Data is cheap. How do you manage it? How do you take into account different fluids? Hydrogen, CO2, natural gas. Can you mix them? Can you ship them? How is the pumping different? There's a lot of material science. There's a lot of computer science. If you're interested in cyber, there have been some big cyber events in recent years. And guess what happens when the cyber event shuts down a pipeline company? The Eastern Seaboard gets no gasoline. You know, it's not a low-tech industry anymore. It's not. And they need people with that kind of interest.
Yeah, we've touched on that a little bit. I mean, we have companies in our industry that are putting out mobile Bitcoin miners. I mean, if you're into Bitcoin or whatever, you can make your own Bitcoin farm with flare gas. You can, we have major midstream companies now are launching their own satellites or buying satellite companies. I mean, you can be a space engineer and work for a midstream company at this point in time. So, you know, I'm wearing a previous company that we had talked to on this podcast, Seacops. They sent me a hat. I asked for some hats and they were one of the folks that did it. So I'm representing them, but you know, they do emissions monitoring via various different technologies, right? Drones and satellites and all the things. So pretty interesting stuff there.
One thing I admit, and I get a little, I don't go over the top in terms of what I say, but a fellow who runs a scholarship fund and he works at Howard Energy Partners in San Antonio. I finished a meeting with him, right? Brought him in and introduced him to three deans at the university because I wanted them to get to know this fellow in this company, and which is working with us a number of things. And when the meeting was over, we're walking out of the building and he turned around and said, "You know what you are?" I was worried it just offended him. He said, "You're an evangelist. You're the midstream evangelist."
Definitely.
I wasn't sure if that was good or bad, except that I am excited about the industry. I'm excited about, you know, the energy in general. I've been focusing on midstream for a while, and there's a lot to focus on, and there's a lot of cool stuff going on.
Well, we'll do a shameless plug here. So you have a couple articles or papers published on the Let's Clear the Air website. Okay. So you can go to the Let's Clear the Air now.org website and click on newsroom, and you can search for a couple of those midstream industry papers and articles that you've written. So I hope we'll invite our audience to do that. But one of them, without giving away kind of the full thing, I want people to go read them, but without giving away the full thing, you discussed the energy transition a little bit. How did that impact you and your career? I mean, you got a longstanding career and there's been a lot of change here lately, but you know, what are your thoughts on kind of how that's progressing and how that even impacted the academia stuff you're doing?
You know, that's a broad and, you know, kind of tough question. Energy transition is big. And what's big about it is that, you know, beyond anything else in our time, trillions of dollars, $1.8 trillion last year into energy transition away from carbon. $1.8 trillion, 22% more than the year before. You know, and so that's where the money goes. What happens with where the money goes? That's where everybody goes. You know, it's where the activity goes. Yeah. And so I was thinking about, you know, what does that mean? You know, are we facing one of these, you know, climate disaster? I don't know. A lot of people have different views. I can't really address that. I don't want to get into a bar conversation. So tremendous amount of money is being spent, and it's being spent more every year, and it's building. And what else do I know? Well, I know if you're spending that kind of money on R&D, you know you're going to get it may not be great investments from the original investors, but you're going to get a lot of new discoveries, a lot of new technologies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking about that, and it made me think of NASA. You know, NASA and Mercury and Apollo programs. John Kennedy's, you know, fly to the moon speech. It was inspirational. It didn't do much for the ordinary guy in the street, but it was inspirational. What it did was it, you know, flushed a whole bunch of seed capital into the most productive seed capital in the history of man into getting to the moon. And out of that, all kinds of stuff happened that nobody dreamed about. It put our entire country 5 to 10 years ahead of the rest of the world in computers and aerospace and things like that, mm-hmm. which, you know, led to us dominating technologies and industries for a lot of years. And all kinds of products and stuff. And so I thought it was a good analogy for where we are today. I don't know what tomorrow's going to bring, but I know the world is being flooded with money in this topic. A lot of good research is being done. Probably a lot of money is being wasted. But I guarantee you, I know two things. The money's being spent, and we're going to get some cool stuff. And I think that the future winners are the ones that are able to identify, harvest, and make something out of the inventions that come out of this effort.
And that article that Adam's talking about, just for the listeners, is titled, "When it comes to rapid energy transition, is spending other people's money a moral hazard of separating actions and consequences, or is it visionary leadership?" Which is a super interesting title, right?
Because that's a different paper than the one I was just talking about. But yeah, that I find that one interesting.
Well, let's talk about this one too, right? Because this one is pretty interesting, kind of just asking that question about, you know, yeah. And you point out like the projects like the great Egyptian pyramids. If you're familiar with what the Saudi royal family is trying to attempt in Saudi Arabia with this big project that's going to basically traverse part of the country. And it is interesting, right? Like the money, the effort, the time, the R&D getting spent into, you know, getting thrown in. And I think you kind of hit on a lot of it, right? Is it moral hazard? Are we preventing a catastrophe, or is, you know, are we, what are we actually doing here, right? Because, you know, a lot of the ideas and conversation around the energy transition feel 30 years ahead of where they actually are at today, right? And yeah. And so I think in that conversation, it's easy to get, you know, I think people get misled to believe this is something that has to be done today, right?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that article and what motivated you to write that.
Well, I was reading the Wall Street Journal, my paper Wall Street Journal one morning, mm-hmm. and with my dog at my feet, coffee in my hand, and I saw this article. And there was articles on the Saudi project, and I saw that they're going to turn like 26,000 square kilometers into a big industrial city and stuff. I thought, wow, that's a big project. And then I saw one of the more interesting elements of the project was it included two multi-trillion dollar buildings, each of them higher than, taller than the Empire State Building and 100 miles long. And looked at that. And the letters OPM jumped into my mind. I thought, you know, that kind of connects me to energy change over time, you know, the energy transition, because there's a lot of uncertainty. Again, I've already covered that, you know, we know the money's been spent, we know we're gonna get good things out of it, what we don't really know yet. And this made me think about motivations. And so I took a look at, you know, monster projects funded by society over time. OPM, society's money. And I looked at the pyramids. Pyramids were kind of, they're really cool from a historical perspective. But, you know, I have to ask the question, was it really in the interests of the people, the society at that time, to spend all of their wealth for 20 generations on building these crypts? You know, people have the good reasons for doing it, but was it really in the interests, or was it the moral hazard of OPM? You know, it's kind of like tails you lose, heads I win. I took the pyramids as being an example of moral hazard. And then I looked at the Saudi project. You know, I can't judge what they're doing, but from my chair, it looks to me like moral hazard time in OPM. You know, separation of action and what happens, yeah. OPM. Then I said, well, you know, you can take this and roll it into rapid energy transition, taking the same perspective. We could take the view that it's a moral hazard issue with OPM, because we're pumping so much money into something so fast, because we got to get it done right now, because we're all going to die. Global temperatures are rising, slow but sure. But is this the right answer, or is it just really the moral hazard coming to play by the people who are in power and have this?
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's a great point, right? Is a juice worth the squeeze, right? Is kind of what you're asking. And
but there are great projects that work. The Manhattan Project. I see that one. I represent that as visionary. Now, what's amazing to me is, you know, you think of all the money, all the national wealth spent in World War II. Almost 1% of it was spent on that one project. A dollar out of every 100 was spent on that one mysterious project, with these half-baked nuclear scientist guys, you know, scratching stuff off that nobody understood. That was visionary, putting the money and stuff behind it, because they had to beat the Nazis to a bomb. The threat was so great, they had to go there. To me, that was visionary on FDR's part. Then along in 56 or something came Eisenhower and the Federal Highway System. Another gigantic project, yes, that would affect every man, woman, and child. It raised gas prices 2 cents a gallon, federal tax to pay for it. And that was a project that, to me, was visionary. It connected, interconnected everybody. It affected every town, state, yeah, county, human being in the United States. It dramatically, I don't have the facts on this right now, but I'll state my opinion. It dramatically enhanced GDP, economic growth, and the welfare of our people. It was a lot of money, $300 billion in today's thing, in a construction project. Are you kidding me?
It's a great way to reconsider a question. I think that a lot of people in the industry, you know, a lot of, you know, people talk about, well, you know, energy poverty, right? Energy reliability, grid security. And I think it was just such an interesting way that you're kind of asking that question and making the point in the article, right? But in like a very different way. And, you know, sometimes it's up to history to decide, right?
Yeah. My real ultimate point is we have to question our motives when we do these things. Is this what we're doing in the best interest of the American people? We care about the world, but we care about the American people. Mm-hmm. We're Americans. And so is this the best way? Could we do it better? You know, and while making this discussion, I seek to avoid what I'll call bar arguments.
Yeah.
You know, shotgun haters. You know, it's trying to address, if we can make people think on all sides of the argument, think things through, what's in the interest of my children's, what's in my children's welfare? You know, if we bankrupt society, we spend all our money on this, you know, and we save the world from an existential threat, perhaps it's worthwhile. You know, a lot of people believe that. So I don't know what to say, but there's a lot of complexity that needs to be considered, and you don't see it talked about out there. You just see like bar arguments.
Yeah, we try and avoid those on this podcast here, even though we, you know, sometimes touch on some edgy subjects and things like that. But certainly a lot of opinions, strong opinions, a lot of money being spent tends to generate that. But we can kind of spin to a more positive aspect of that, right? Is, you know, we talked a lot about innovation, a lot of money being spent. So, you know, what in your opinion are some cool innovations that you've seen or have heard of or funded in the past? And I'd just be curious kind of, you know, how you're interacting with those and what you're seeing on that side.
Okay. Well, I can talk to one project, which is a favorite of mine, I worked on for several years. And right now there's a PHMSA grant out for $1 million to support it. And there's a professor named Dr. Udamari, who's leading the team at Lamar. And the objective was to I did a small project first to see what the issues were. And the objective was to take geohazard information, like from LIDAR and NSAR, you know, from planes flying over, shooting lasers at the ground. You could see what the elevations are and how it changes over time. And NSAR, some satellites. The government collects a lot of that stuff, and they're going to make the national database available this year. And so looking at that, and there's no aggregated, integrated database for that stuff. It just exists there. So industry has all these very complex data models where they're trying to figure out what's a threat to my pipeline. I got 10,000 miles of pipeline. Where should I focus my attention? Where should I do it? You know, there, I don't know. Where are the flags? And they send smart pigs through and they get bends and they get all kinds of information. But one thing if they don't get good information on is the geohazard stuff. And so the ultimate objective of taking the NSAR, LIDAR, monument, weather data into one database and coming out with ultimately what you're looking for is probability of soil movement. And then having this and creating this database and creating from my vision of this was to create a database that's updated regularly, that's a subscription service to industry, so that industry can go wherever they have their pipelines, they can go and they can download, you know, the geohazard information that they could then integrate into their risk models along their pipelines. And this would help them meet the requirements which are coming out of PHMSA, where companies have to be more proactive. They have to say, No longer you can say, well, the soil moved, it busted, I did everything right. Now you have to say, well, I should have known the soil was going to move, it busted, and then they get hammered, punched in the face because they didn't know. Well, you have to be more proactive. And that's so that was a project of mine. It's relatively low tech because it's really taking stuff that's there and seeking to integrate it and turn it into actionable information. And I'm very proud of that one. I'm fingers crossed for Dr. Udamari at Lamar. It's a plug for him. That he gets that $1 million from PHMSA. I funded him on projects relating that twice to sort of get a foundation of knowledge so that we could actually go for industry or PHMSA funding. PHMSA offered the opportunity first, so that's out there. That'll come back this summer maybe. That's an example. Is that a good one?
Super interesting. Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of places in the U.S. here have had flooding recently, and I always think about, like, you know, when a house rolls down a hill or collapses into a river or whatever, what happens to all the connections to that home?
Like, it broke.
Yeah, that's sort of what you're talking about a little bit. So very interesting there. So are there any other, you know, opportunities that you're looking at moving forward? Like you mentioned the grant stuff, but I mean, as someone with sort of an investment background, I mean, where would someone go to look for funding or opportunities or grants? You know, how do you find those? How do you look for those?
Well, you know, Department of Transportation, PHMSA, puts out, you know, calls for proposals regularly, and those are academic proposals. PRCI, Pipeline Resource Council International, is an industry organization that works with all the, they have as members, all the pipeline companies, a lot of the service companies, and they do a lot of industry company-driven research projects, and they contract a lot of that out to universities. If I was looking, and they fund some stuff, that funding comes from the companies, and they can help people get funding from FIMS and other people. PRCI is an organization that, if I was interested in this topic, I would call them up. You'd look them up. They're here in Houston. Great organization, very helpful. I would also say that one thing I'm looking to do is, I retired from Lamar recently, and they're going to take that. I think they're going to take the center in a slightly different direction, more academic, internally focused. They're going to put an academic in charge of it. And I'm looking to stand up another midstream center focused on what I've been doing, which is really focused on the outside industry and the value proposition to industry. That is the purpose, delivering value to society through delivering it to the industry. And I know I'm talking to one university right now, and they seem very interested, a number of the deans there. And if I can wrap myself in their banner, I'll go to the midstream industry, you know, and see if I can raise some capital. And I've got to a plug. At the end of the day, it'll cost about $1.4 million a year for everything, total costs. Everything. And so I'm trying to set that up right now. It's a discussion that I'm pursuing.
It's great news. I mean, anything we can do to continue to add to the industry and the education and information is awesome. So
there's a lot of room. Again, keep in mind, 160 or so energy centers. Right at the moment, there's one midstream center.
Well, I'll let Andrew step in here. I got a couple questions on that here in a minute, though.
No, take it away, man. We're coming up on time, so don't let me hog.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, before we do our wrap-up question, which is pretty standard on every episode, but, you know, looking ahead, you know, with potential of popping up another midstream educational, you know, organization, but what do you see the future of midstream companies, you know, whether it's in the next decade, and, you know, how do you think they can adapt to these, you know, emerging trends and deal with the energy transition stuff? And just what does the future look like for you?
Well, you know, unfortunately, a lot of that has to do with, you know, it's the political framework in our nation. Mm-hmm. You know, today, companies have there's a lot of acquisition of existing assets. It's very difficult to get permitting across state lines. If you're within a state that is warm to oil and gas, you know, assets, it's relatively easy. But even, like, I can't think of the states, probably in Kansas, Nebraska, there's a CO2 project up there, a CO2 sequestration project. It was doing everything public policy wants. It had public money lined up. And it was like a several billion-dollar project. It got shut down because they couldn't deal with permitting going across several state jurisdictions. And I think that, and part of that is because, you know, people not in my backyard kind of thing, but also that it's just the, you know, the dynamics today lead to things like that. And so I think that industry and companies are having to make more and more, make do in a lot of cases with what they have and make things, you know, be able to continue on or improve them or build within state boundaries and things like that. It's very practical stuff.
Yeah.
But they're really smart people. The midstream companies, they know how to manage. They know how to project manage, design, build, operate. They will get done whatever they're allowed to get done. It's kind of like, my view is like, the perfect rules, loose the horses. But, you know, these are really social issues I frankly try and stay away from.
So, you know, to that end, we're running up on an election here. We ask this question to everyone as we sort of roll out here, but it's 3 years from now. You're back on our podcast. Everything's going great with it. And you're happy. You're in a great mood. You're coming back on. What has happened to make you feel that way and make Mr. Tom happy to be on our podcast again?
I guess we've accomplished something. You know, whether it's in support of energy transition, we've been able to develop technology, we've been able to build, we've been able to do things to serve society. And one thing happens when you get older, like me, I'm old as dirt, is that you really start thinking more and more. You're not really thinking about career anymore. You're thinking about what comes next, what your children, grandchildren are going to be seeing. And you become more interested in the welfare of the people. And you have to be careful because you get wrapped up in your own ego and you think your interests are the people's interests, that kind of thing. But, you know, what would make me happy is if the development of energy, all types of energy, is thoughtfully coordinated with the objective of bringing efficiency, low cost, you know, energy growth to our nation, which frankly is needed to improve the cost of the standard of living and make things a better world. Our entire society, frankly, has been based on inexpensive energy. It's a foundation.
Right.
And so I hope to participate in that, and we'll see.
Well, thank you so much for the conversation. I mean, I feel like we can continue on for a few more hours if we wanted to. We try and keep them in short bites for the audience, but how can our audience reach you? Any websites, social media, anything like that that you participate in?
You know, I'm on LinkedIn. That's all I can tell you. If you want to reach out to me for something, have my email if you want to give it out to the people.
We'll get with Kevin and put that in the notes. And if anyone wants to reach out, we'll definitely provide that. So thanks again. Andrew, got any closing statements here?
No. Super. I didn't know what to expect, but man, what a wealth of knowledge you are, Tom. And I'm going to be hitting up Kevin for more of those essays because the few that he shared ahead of time were super awesome. And I think some of them, if folks want to check them out, some of them get posted to the Let's Clear the Air website. So make sure you go on and read a few of them because they're very thought provoking. So appreciate your time today.
They're also short.
Yeah, they're super easy to read. When I saw like, oh, here's an essay, I'm like, oh man, I don't have 20 minutes to read this thing, but it was nice and easy. So yeah. Awesome.
Hey, thank you for having me. You know, people sort of joke, my kids joke and friends like, I'd like to talk about things that interest me. I am a little bit of an evangelist in the energy environment.
Thank you for doing that. Yeah, thank you for doing that. Keep sharing the good information. Best of luck with your endeavors moving forward. And to our audience, definitely make sure you subscribe, make sure you follow, make sure you go to the website and check out everything that Let's Clear the Air is doing. And we look forward to chatting with you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast with Adam Murray and Dr. Andrew Parker. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.